Hey, you're listening to Block Thinking with Werner Puchert.
So you might have heard me mention the College of Extraordinary Experiences quite a few times in this podcast before. Well, this week I'm super excited to bring you one of the co-founders of the college, Paul Balencia. Not only is Paul one of the co-organizers of the event, but he's also a co-author of the book Gamification and Tourism that touches on a lot of topics related to the experience economy. Now, one of the great things about the college is that you get involved with this whole community of college alumni and friends who ultimately become family. We don't really talk about nationality, except for maybe a few South African jokes from yours truly. That being said, is that Paul is actually a Romanian experience designer, and he's had an impact both here in Europe and internationally on the field of experience design. And I think it's something to be really proud of for this region. A conversation with Paul can also be quite an interesting experience in itself. And the thing that I get mostly out of my interactions with Paul is that I feel like he's still seeking a lot of answers himself. But then again, is it about the destination or making the journey of seeking and finding these answers a beautiful experience in itself? It's for you to decide. We reference a lot of topics, authors, and events during the course of this conversation, and I did my best to note all of this down in the show notes, and I really encourage you to go check them out. There's some interesting stuff. Thanks for listening.
Hello everyone, my name is Paul Balencia. I am from Romania but living abroad since more than 8 years now, and it is hard to say what I actually do because I wear many, many hats, but I consider myself to be an experienced designer, learning every day. As what people might recognize me by is I am the co-author of a book called Gamification in Tourism, Designing Memorable Experiences, launched in 2015. Worked a lot in doing consulting and presentations, keynotes about experience design based on game design thinking. And then I transitioned together with Jobak LARP Studios in the live action role play field. And together with them, I also created the College of Extraordinary Experiences. I think Werner was also, Werner was also part of this. He's a third.
Yeah, thanks for noticing me being there.
He's a third year student by now. And we're doing lots of stuff. I'm also an entrepreneur. I love to snowboard. I used to work as a snowboard instructor. I consider that to be my first experience design job. And I'm pretty stoked to be on this podcast here with my good friend, Werner.
Dude, I'm super stoked to have you on this podcast. And I think this was a very serious introduction, but there is a bit of non-seriousness to Paul, right? So I think let's start off the non-seriousness with the Batmobile joke.
Oh, yeah. That's a joke that lots of people want to hear. So Klaus and I, who's my partner from Jobak LARP Studios, we're doing this experience in the Emirates. We're a crew of 36 international people staying on an entertainment island for 1 month. And we did a live action role play experience at a water park there. And at one point we got invited at this very high profile Asia Travel Awards at the Ferrari World. So everyone was super, super nicely dressed. Everyone was serious. And Klaus went on the stage to introduce me and the crew that were doing this experience, Legends of Arabia, inspired by all the Arabian legend experience where we all had foam swords running around and role-playing with hundreds of people. And he went on stage and he said, hello, my name is Klaus, and I would like to introduce my partner. His name is Paul, but usually by our crew, we're being called Batman and Robin. And when the hotel staff overheard that, they asked us, so where is your Batmobile? And then we said, we didn't bring our Batmobile because in the Emirates, this would look like a cheap secondhand car. And there was complete silence, hundreds of people, no one laughing. So we actually looked at the recording. The silence on stage felt like forever, but it was just for like 1 second. And then Klaus was like, all right, so now we have someone behind the stage, our bandits that stole the princess. Who wants to fight them and get a sword? And there were some people that volunteered. And he said, okay, now let's hear a war cry from everyone. So he tried to make everyone say like, oh, oh. And he started yelling like that. But no one was picking up on it. I was even embarrassed to pick up. But he kept on going. And that's the thing that I like about Klaus, that he's very determined to make things work. He kept on going, and then he got some support, and then he realized, okay, now maybe it's the best time to stop. And then some people came and started fighting the bandits. And that was pretty pretty hilarious experience.
Brilliant, dude. I love that. What I usually ask my guests here is that, Paul, what is your value proposition?
I think my value proposition is looking at whatever it is that someone is doing and then coming with a completely wild proposal on changing it. So I'm the outlier of creative thinking when it comes to being in a project. I'm coming up with really, really, really crazy solutions. So people call me that I'm a person that is from outside of this universe when it comes to thinking and changing things.
I've seen you at play. So you do come from the left field. As you mentioned before, you are the author of the Gamification and Tourism. And something that I found very inspiring when I first opened up the book was that you have a little note there. For my family, they encouraged me to play and explore the world. Because for me, you're kind of the citizen of the world. But ultimately, you grew up in Romania.
You told me that you have lots of listeners from Central and Eastern Europe. So I guess they can all relate with my story of living in a post-communist country. I was fortunate enough to, until I was six, to live at the countryside and have a beautiful house with lots of green space. So I was spending most of my days exploring, and I had this tractor with pedals, so I was just going very far, playing lots with nature, gathering fruits, but I was really an explorer and an adventurer. And then we moved to the city, and my parents divorced, and I had to go through this really tough family situation where we had to, together with my mom, we had to move house. And I think we moved six or seven times until I was 21. So I was already a nomad in my own city with my family. And I guess that really played as a nice transition into my life, moving onward as a nomad. But growing up in post-communist Romania was pretty interesting just because it was quite tough, I must say. I remember when the first designed experience came out, and I was like maybe 10 years old. It was McDonald's, and then my neighbors that I was playing with was completely stoked about that. And I really wanted to go there. And my mom couldn't afford to go to McDonald's, if you think about it, right? Back in the day.
Wow.
So we had to go there once a month when she was getting the salary. And I remember collecting everything from McDonald's. I was completely blown away by how this slide can turn you from one. If you go on your belly, you end up on your back down because this spiral.
Yeah.
I was completely blown away. I also remember how we had to portion this Raffaello candy. We could just buy one, and I had to split it with my sister because we couldn't afford to buy a whole package. So it's quite tough living there. And also because there were lots of pickpockets back in the day. And I remember once I was so stoked about going to McDonald's, and then my mom, they just stole her wallet with the whole salary in it.
Damn.
I was like, shit. I was only concerned of not going to McDonald's. My mom was devastated, of course, but I was like so sad. I really don't like what's going on with the country. It's really tough to live in a post-communist country, especially with so many shady deals going around and so many groups of people that profit based on their relations and not on talent and on giving value to society. So it's this ambivalent feeling. But then I also had the good parts of and my own troubles with the police and so on, growing up as a skater and a snowboarder.
Oh, yeah.
I had my pretty rebellious growing up in this ambivalent country, so to say.
I mean, you valued that McDonald's experience, you know, like if you think back of it now, you go like, damn, it's McDonald's. But
yeah,
perhaps the appreciation for that experience back then, I mean, I also remember McDonald's coming into South Africa, by the way, but having that experience for that small, or that appreciation for that small experience back then, do you think that awakened your hunger to have these bigger experiences? Or perhaps this, I mean, when I look at you, you also have this intense appreciation for what people try to create. Do you think it started there already?
That's a good question about when it started. Not sure. I think right now, if I look back to it with the knowledge that I have, I could say, yes, it started there. But if I reflect on my experience, I think it started way later when I did my bachelor's and I entered a student organization called ISEC. ISEC is the world's largest student organization, and it is a platform to create leaders. And I think I was really blown away by how they design conferences. And to this day, I think ISEC has some of the world's best conferences.
Whoa, okay.
In terms of how they're designed.
And then how do you move from like this event stuff focusing on tourism?
So my whole studies were about looking at tourism and how to design experiences in that field. And if we think a little bit about tourism and the tourism industry, they're kind of the first experienced designers in when it comes to business. But most of them are not aware that they're designing experiences. They're just thinking, okay, I'm designing a tour, I'm designing a museum, and so on. Tourism is really good at astonishing people, at giving them that physical experience. But what tourism fails to do is keep an engagement curve spanning across the time. So if you're on a cruise ship or if you're on an island, you will not be engaged or immersed for the entire duration of the trip. You will be very much, you will take your phone out to do pictures. You'll be distracted. You will experience all sorts of feelings that you will not necessarily follow a red thread of the experience that brings you an interesting value. So that's where I identified an opportunity proposed by my professor, Roman Egger. He proposed to look into gamification or how to use game design thinking to enhance experiences. And what games are doing that tourism is not doing, of course, they also excite and astonish people, but not to the same degree.
Yeah.
But what they're really good at is engagement. They engage people over like a long period of time. People are super engaged in what they're doing and the activity that they're doing. So in the thesis, I looked at both game design and experience design from a tourism perspective, and I merged them together. And then we used as a case study experiment, a museum from Salzburg, a beer museum. And we did like four little things. They had, for example, different types of malt for the beer. You can taste the malt in the beer museum, but that's it. So what we did is we took this malt and we made a tasting station. And then in a different room, we made a guessing station.
Ah.
So you had to choose which malt is which. Another one was, there was the central piece of the museum was this big, big painting about the beer production process. So we took that painting and we split it up in 20 pieces and we made it a puzzle. So we put in small beer bottles spread all around the museum. We put this pieces of the puzzle and people had to find them. And these pieces were strategically positioned into places that people usually didn't visit in the museum, but they're interesting corners.
Yeah.
But they were not on, you know, on the main route. So this served the purpose of them discovering these interesting pieces that were otherwise left out. And also, in some cases, they were triggering sensors. So in this case, because Mozart was drinking beer there, it just triggered a sensor was Mozart was playing. And all of a sudden, you're finding the story of Mozart. And then at the end, we had 300 people go through the experiment. And we had a control and a test group. And we measured the experience of them. And interestingly enough, with minimum effort done by only one student with no pay volunteer basis, very young in this field, there was a significant difference in the experience of the visitors in how they perceive their time, loss of time in the gamified experience, and how they're remembering it. And we also did a qualitative study, and I remember this beautiful story with a mom coming in with three children and hearing them from the gate, but mom, I don't want to go to a beer museum. 45 minutes after they went in, they came out and I heard the same little girl, which was 8 years old, said, can we go in again and do it again?
But that's exactly what you want, right?
Yes, I just love that moment. So this thesis, I got lucky enough to present it at the World Travel Market in London. And my professor and I saw, okay, this is a very good time and it's a very good field and people are receptive to it. So we managed to get a funding from the university and work for the next 1.5 years on creating this book.
What I truly love about the book is you really tap into a lot of the frameworks that is kind of still current and very, very relevant in experience design, like the flow model. I mean, and then also you have created your own model here. It's called the Memorable Experience Design Framework. I mean, we'll post a link to the book, but maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the value that came out of this book.
In terms of the book, what I identified by doing lots of research was the PERMA model done by Martin Seligman. And Martin Seligman is a person that has been a psychologist for a long period of time and got frustrated with the fact that psychology, up to a point where he decided to do something about it, was only focusing on how to cure disease. But there was no research scientific field focusing on, all right, we know how to bring people from -7 to zero patients. And when they're at zero, it's like, okay, I have no issues, but I'm numb.
Yeah.
So they're saying, like, how can we bring people from zero to +3 or from zero to +9? So he started together with Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who is the writer of the flow theory. They started a new field in psychology called positive psychology. But he looked in well-being, and then he identified these five elements, which are the PERMA model, yeah, which is positive emotions, engagement, meaning, accomplishment, and relationships. So experiencing a good degree of each of these elements in your life. And what was fascinating to me was I looked at, okay, the subtitle of the book is Designing Memorable Experiences. That's what actually the book is about, and looks in tourism, in game design, psychology, socials, many, many fields. And I was fascinated to see that if we look at the tourism experience,
yeah,
it's all of these five elements. So I made this chart where I identified that, okay, the reason why people travel, the reason why people find tourism experience memorable is because of experiencing more of these five elements, all of them or some of them to a certain degree. And then Jane McGonigal, who's an awesome games researcher,
yeah,
also identified a similar pattern in video games.
And it's interesting how all this then ultimately then translates into experience design as a field.
Exactly. And there's so many ways to create experiences. And that's the reason why I just said, okay, let's look at these elements and then see from there. It's like, okay, do I have this in my experience? Do I have that? And then if relationships is missing, people kind of intuitively know that this element is missing. And if they know that an element is missing, they don't need necessarily a theory, but they just need to think, okay, how do I incorporate bonding in this experience, right? Where do I leave space for that, and so on? And of course, each element in the book has lots of tips and tricks on how to design for it, inspired from game design.
And what are experience designers doing that service designs aren't doing?
This has so many elements, but I think the easiest way to design for experiences, right, is you need to have the people that spend time with you. They need to be actively involved, right? They need to be in a game. The people are actively involved, right? I just remember playing PlayStation with my girlfriend. There's a huge difference between her watching me play single player mode and her having a joystick as well.
Yeah.
It's huge. So you need to give the people that come to spend time with you joysticks,
yeah,
so that they start playing as well, right? They need to be part of it. And this is like, it's very easy and subtle change in words, right? Lots of people every time when I hear the word consumer, my brain, it like suffers and explodes.
Yeah.
And I've been to lots of conferences. Like, every time when I hear the word consumer, I just want to have tomatoes and throw at people on stage, because this creates a culture that is not for today anymore. And that's why I really love to replace the word consumer, customer, guest, or so on. These are all passive.
Yeah.
With the word participant.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you have a participant, then you design differently. The word participant has an active engagement element in its own definition. So if you say, okay, we have not 20 customers coming to our business, we have 20 participants coming to our water park, right? Then you already have an experience designer hat on.
Experience is staged things. You have to stage an experience. But I think I like the way that you take it a little bit further and say, cool, the people who are experiencing it should be participants.
Exactly. I mean, in terms of staging, I think that staging is great, but I have changed my mind along the years, because staging means you have a passive audience.
Yeah, you have to be careful with that, right?
So I changed from staging to creating environments where experiences can happen. And involving participants to create experiences themselves, right? That's why I like the metaphor and analogy of you don't need to stage something, you just have to create a sandbox. So all you have to do is to put the right props inside the sandbox and then let the people build with them, right? And you still have a high level of control because it's a huge difference if you put a shovel in a sandbox versus if you put, let's say, a puddle of water. People are going to interact and do different things with the shovel and with the water.
But you know what? It's super interesting that you mentioned this sandbox analogy. I spoke to a friend last week. She's hosting an event. And like any event designer, I'm sure you can identify with that as well, Paul. She was a bit nervous, right? Do I have enough stuff there to make people excited? Have I done enough? And I said to her at some stage, this is a week or two before their event. You have created the sand pit. You've put some toys in there for people. Now you have to let go to allow people to play with these toys and create things. Because I think there's a risk sometimes with these things. There are two elements that came up for me in this conversation. First of all, putting too much toys in the sand pit is not going to leave any space for the participant to play.
Yeah.
The second thing, which is probably the toughest thing to do in experience design, is to let go, right?
Yep.
Because at some stage, you need to hand over the experience to the participant for him or her to have that experience. And that's sometimes tough for an experience designer to do. I mean, we want to control everything and make sure it's a good thing, but you have to let go. Like, do you have any thoughts to riff on that? Because I think you've dealt with that one a few times.
Yeah, I just cannot help but thinking about you cannot see the sand because of too many toys, right?
Exactly. There's no place for the poor kid, man.
So people are going to hurt themselves in the sharp edges of the too many toys that you put there.
Yeah.
I think as a designer, I've grown a lot. And I think more and more, my North Star is a quote from a Romanian sculptor called Brâncuș. And he said, simplicity is complexity resolved.
Nice.
And I learned this the hard way from doing events is, how can you make this simple? Both from a logistical perspective, both from the team that is supposed to facilitate this, by removing as many unnecessary steps as possible and make it as simple as it can get. So I think having this filter of how can I make this simple will help you remove all the toys that are not needed laying out. And I think one of the things that I learned in experience design was I always made sure I had enough toys in my backpack if they're needed. But then I also realized that during the event, it was very hard to keep them in the backpack. Because, of course, you have toys, you want to share them and show them around, right? But then once you bring the toys out, people are going to get distracted. And this is the easiest example that I can give. We had a 20-person Zoom meeting two nights ago, and my girlfriend wanted to show her cat because the cat just came close to us. And then someone was speaking. And I just muted myself and said, don't show the cat now because all the people are going to be distracted by the cat and the person speaking, no one is going to listen to. And even though it's very hard not to show your cat to everyone because it's so cute and everyone will appreciate it.
Dude, everybody loves a cat, right?
Exactly. So I think you need to have that sharp mind of, okay, I know this would be a positive experience for everyone to see the cat, but it's not the right moment. Yeah. And maybe we don't even have to show the cat at all.
Exactly.
So I think that's one type of thinking of having the strength determination of not showing your toys, even though they're super cool. But making sure you have enough toys in your backpack if they're needed.
That's the thing, right? You have to have something up your sleeve. I think what we need to do is talk about a few of the examples of the cases that you have, right? And I think I'm going to kick off with the box nightmare.
Oh, that was lots and lots and lots of learning. So IKEA centers are people that own shopping centers and shopping malls. So not the furniture, but it's a shopping mall. And we first try to identify who are we designing for. And there was this active listening method and active listening work. So you go in the environment of the people, you try to get as a diverse sample as possible, usually 20 people, let's say, and then you go and deep dive into 1, 2, 3 hours conversations when you just let the people talk and you just give them small prompts. And there were 3 main findings that came out of that is society is sick. we live in a hamster wheel. And we don't know how to get out. And the third one is, I feel like a number. I remember someone was saying is like, okay, this person has passed away. And when they went to clean the house, they found this closet full with stuff that still had labels on them, and how they're actually trapped in this instant gratification materialism trap, and they're aware of it, but they have a hard time escaping their job. They have a hard time escaping this monster that we have created. And then IKEA centers recognize the fact that they need to move from a shopping center experience to an experience center, right? And people as an experience center, and they're all talking about, we want engagement, we want self-development, we want community, we want all of this. So that's how we started with. And then we applied rapid prototyping into this. But this is a very long story. So to keep it short is, we had a 300 square meter space, and we said the only way that we can create experiences is to accelerate the learning curve for the customers. So we had 300 square meter space, and we bought more than 2,000 boxes and lots of props and furniture from IKEA. 7 teams that were locally recruited of artists and from multidisciplinary fields. And we had, in a span of 1 week, every day we had this open for 4 hours a day. And this environment had 7 different experience spaces. And customers were coming in. We were rapidly changing their experience based on how they were reacting to each.
The whole thing was a prototype, but then you tweaked some of the experiences inside this during the whole process.
It's something that Klaus and I are realizing that we're doing is what we call the field of live design, where you have the sandbox, you have the props, we have a process, and you're changing it based on real life feedback, where you're in the shopping center, they're the real customers coming in, and this space was surrounded by bookcases, and there was a wardrobe, like in Narnia. And you can step through the wardrobe, and then you're going through this labyrinth of boxes that had 7 different experiences. So we made a mini mall, and we used boxes to lay it out. And what happened was we even changed the layout while the people were going in, depending on how they were. So it was like always moving it to a very accelerated pace. And at the end of the day, we're destroying the whole space, like all the 2,000 boxes, and starting from scratch, rethinking the whole layout, rethinking the whole experiences, trying to even merge and mix the people. It was very hard for us as facilitators to make the people that were designing the experience change faster, right? So that's what I called, that was an experience design accelerator.
Accelerator being the key word here. Yeah. And ultimately, what was the result of this?
So the final takeaway was that it was great that we had the volunteers become better at designing experiences, but the people that had to be there instead should have been the people that were managing the shopping center. Because after such an experience, they're learning on how to design experiences for the customers and where the pain points are and how to use rapid prototyping and experience design. Could have increased exponentially versus them just being the observers and the receivers of such a project.
So it comes down to that whole idea of stakeholder buy-in, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I would really love if experience design, which is, if you ask me, ultimately being able to sculpt your own time, I would really love to have this being already as courses elementary school, because this would change a lot. You just really take the ownership of how you spend your time and how the people that you decide to create something for spend their time as being thought by yourself. I really want to give you a quote here in terms of the reason why experience design is so needed. It's because everything looks the same. I'm just looking out the window right now and I see all communist gray buildings everywhere. Airports are the same, train stations are the same, hotels are the same. I still remember my professor saying that there is no space for innovation in the hospitality field. Everything has been done already. And I was like, what are you talking about? There is space for radical innovation, and people are really afraid of radical innovation. And that's why they keep people in their offices, right, not being involved in such projects, to keep on working on incremental innovation. And here's the quote that I would like to share from you. It's from Jeff Vandermeer: the world is filled with people who have too much imagination solely because the people around them have too little.
That is very interesting.
And that's why businesses and shopping centers and train stations and airports and governments and you name it are still going to look the same, even though the flavor is going to change a little bit. Because no one has the courage of doing radical innovation and putting all the resources and all the effort into that.
Dude, and then the next one I wanted to talk about, the work you did in Dubai at the Water Wall.
That was Abu Dhabi, actually.
Abu Dhabi. Sorry, I'm reading this wrong. I should read. My reading experience failed.
It's all right.
Abu Dhabi. Sorry, Dubai.
there is actually a huge competition between Dubai and Abu Dhabi.
So I just open up a whole...
Yeah, can of worms. But it's all right. You will get some interesting comments from people from there. It's very interesting to work in the Middle East because, right, Pine and Gilmore is talking about the experience economy. And I think that they had the luck of burning several stages in the process of the progress of economic value, and they just moved directly to experience. And if you ask me what they're experiencing, there is commoditization of experiences, where experiences become commodities, where they just want to build theme parks from Dubai to Abu Dhabi. They have so many. Yeah. And I remember working in that field and finding out that for the opening of the Legoland, very few people showed up and some of them had to be paid to be there.
Jeez, because people are coming numb to
exactly,
it.
Exactly, right? So we took this concept and we brought it to Abu Dhabi to a theme park, which was a water park, yes, Water World. And during the day, it was a normal water park with rides, slides, swimming pools, and all sorts of water-based activities. But the park itself is one of the best themed parks in the world. So it truly looks like you're stepping inside an Emirati legend, and the theming is done really, really nice. So it closes at 6 o'clock, and then during the night, they were not using the park for anything.
It's dead.
So in December, during the night, the temperature is really nice. And they had lots of grasshoppers, lots of beautiful Arabian-themed lanterns, and lots of nature. It was really, really pleasant. So we took the park, and then we looked at the story of the park. And we built on that a 3-hour live-action role-play experience where people were showing up, and they were receiving costumes and foam swords. And they were becoming part of one of the 5 clans of the park, each inspired by a location in the park.
Welcome to the Legends of Arabia.
And for the next 3 hours, they had to go through this live action story. So of having a tribe leader, which was one of our people as experience facilitator. And then all 5 tribes had to meet at the beginning, where the old man that used to lead all the tribes had to step down, and they were looking for a new leader. And they couldn't find an understanding between them, so they all started fighting. So the first act of the experience was basically conflict, and then was trying to solve the conflict under pressure, because if they didn't find their leader by the end of the game, they would all be cursed. And then was collaboration and at the end, resolution. And I mean, just to give you a scene, we had bandits, we had people running around doing fights, we had animal spirits. People really, really engaged into this, like 150 people running around costumed. So for example, a tribe leader was telling us the story of how this little kid was like maybe 12, being there with the sword, saying, I'm afraid of entering the cave because it's dark. And was also with the parents. And then the tribe leader just gave like a positive encouragement and said, like, grab your swords with both hands, keep it in front of you, and have no fear.
Man.
And you see this, the kid just breathing in, grabbing the sword and going in and building that confidence. And the parents supporting the child and building this bonding with play. And then fighting the bandits together and you know, like building family, team building one.
Yeah.
The second one was in a place where segregation is quite big, which is the Emirates. We were having like 45 to 50 nationalities per game, interacting, supporting each other, having each other's backs, right?
Building bridges.
And then at the end of the experience, people are taking pictures, and also like this big Arabian buffet, where people could talk about their experience, share, and break bread. People came in there most of them, they came there expecting to be consumers and not participants.
Yeah, and that mindset, right?
And they were finding out that they're participants, they had this shock.
Yeah.
A huge shock. Yeah, I think this is a big learning is people want to be participants. They're like thinking that they want to be, they want to experience that. But because there is nothing out there as a benchmark and a reference, when they actually get to do that, they're shocked.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, we leave space for people not to put pressure on them and they can be observers in the experience, but they're still participating because in order to observe the experience, they have to run around with their tribe and they risk of being attacked by someone.
Yeah.
Right?
You gave me this opportunity once with Klaus to attend one of the LARPs that you guys do. Going there, I mean, I've never done a live action role-playing thing in my life. What you just described resonates with me because you are observing this. It's completely amazing, but you're also feeling a bit uncomfortable, kind of follow the flow because people are on this journey, on this narrative. You know, like how do you prepare people or how do you get people ready? Like, should you be getting people ready?
The shock that people have when the experience being participants is that they're not used to this. This is something completely new. But as soon as they get a hang of it, we had people that came 4 to 5 to 6 times. Because, I mean, in such a sandbox, the repeat experience is always different because you can become better at it and then you start becoming a leader or you take a different role or you support others' experiences. You're focused on winning the game or you're focused on doing this and that. And again, it all comes down. It's like, what is your intention as an experience director? What do you want people to feel? And then there's so many nuances that you can give to people.
There's one last one I just want to lightly touch on, which I think that you were involved with that was quite interesting. And I think it was a prototype in itself. Maybe a little bit more on the live action role-playing side is the road trip.
So the road trip experience is this live action role-play experience where you start off with a rock band in Chicago. You go along Route 66 and you play, you're part of the band playing different gigs along the route. And then you end up in LA for a final concert. And everyone involved is role-playing this, right? So people that apply to be part of the band, of course, you need some skill to know how to play an instrument or be good with your voice. But everyone that applied was role-playing this. So if you're applying to the band, you already have a given band name and you already have a given narrative, which is you're part of this very famous band that is for the first time on tour in the US. And you're famous on this radio show that became viral in Romania and Bulgaria. So no one knows in the US where Romania and Bulgaria is anyways.
Yeah.
So I had people playing different roles like band member, groupie, MC, the person that puts the band on stage. I was role playing a drug dealer. And it was the first time when we actually mixed, right? Because usually when we do events like in the water park or we do events in castles that are 4 days.
Yeah, it's kind of closed in, right? It's got its safety zone around.
It's closed in. But here we merged the what we call the magic circle of play with reality.
Yeah. Because, I mean, just for people listening just to understand is that when you went into to go play a gig or when you rolled into a little town or village or whatever, as you stayed in character and the people that you engaged with didn't necessarily know that you were in character. They were just doing their everyday stuff.
So I was introducing myself as Bastion. I had a fake Instagram account and people were interacting with me. We had people following us. So I got to experience some really crazy roads that otherwise would have never happened without us having this alibi and creating the illusion for the outside world that we're this. So we ended up in LA and there was a very beautiful closing ritual because we had the spiritual leader in the guy that was playing a spiritual leader. He did a great job.
Yeah.
And the ending of the experience was you go in the ocean. So you go with him and he was just saying, okay, he was praising everything that you contributed to the band. And then he was saying, okay, now you're going inside the water as Bastion and then you're coming up back as Paul.
As Paul.
And it was really strong. When you're playing with reality, at that point, it really makes you realize that the universe is not made of atoms. It is made of stories, right? And when you're role-playing different stories, you realize that it is all story and narrative, right?
It's so interesting because, I mean, sometimes we forget that even the big corporations and things that we work for, they are also just stories that other people have made
up. They're all stories. Equity is a story. Being a startup is a story. Everything.
Money is a story.
So what I really like about live action role play is, and I think it's one of the best mediums where you, if you go into, you don't need a course on experience design. You don't need an MBA on experience design. You just start role playing and you immediately start thinking like an experience designer, because you have to play with narrative. You have to play with design of fiction. You have to play with suspension of disbelief. You have to play with shifting mindset. You have to play with psychology. Right? You have to play with mechanics.
Yeah.
So you learn the learning curve is very high.
I have this thing where I ask my previous guest to pay forward with a question. So I spoke to Olga Skocilis and she had a question for you. Is that, have you ever had ethical concerns about some of the stuff that you've done?
The number one thing that is most important for the people that you want me to create this for is that they opt in. And here's what I like about Jason Silva, who touches sometimes upon the field of experience design, is humans, by nature, we're built to have our guards up all the time. So one way to reduce friction or to make people understand is by, this might sound interesting, is lubricating them into transformation, lubricating them into the experience.
But clearly making it from the start that opting out and making it public for everyone is completely fine, and meaning it. That's really important, right? Meaning it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And that's one way to deal with the ethical concerns, is like letting people out. And I think the biggest challenges that we had were with clients that forced their employees to be there. They were not agreeing with them opting out because they paid for it, the people traveled and so on. And one way to get buy-in is what we do with the college is... So Jesse Schell, who's a game designer, calls this the lens of the toy, right? So my girlfriend has here a huge teddy bear. It's right in front of me. So it's the lens of the huge teddy bear. Is like where you place something or you put something that looks so amazing. You just want to engage with it without thinking. And that's what the college is. Who would not want to opt out being at a Harry Potter looking like castle for 5 days with these extraordinary people being engaged in all sorts of amazing stuff?
And Paul, that is exactly what I want to talk about next. And that is the College of Extraordinary Experiences.
What the world needs is a new kind of conference, especially one focused on experiences themselves. And that's the why. That's why I'm so excited about this very different breed of conference, the College of Extraordinary Experiences.
I mean, you've done this now for 3 years in a row,
yes.
Right? Please tell us more about it.
I'm going to try to explain this in a new way that I didn't try to, but let's see if it works. I recently started going into the field of space exploration. I got fascinated by it. So it is not that we teach people by them being immersed in this experience how to become better experience designers. And here's where I relate to the term of escape velocity. If we think of a rocket, right, launching from Earth, it needs to have 11,000 kilometers per hour or more in order to be able to escape the gravitational pull of Earth. For the rocket to reach that speed, especially right in the first phase where they're just like have to push against the thickness of the atmosphere, it requires lots of energy, lots of catalyst movement. So I see the college as bringing in all of these diverse groups of people, and each comes with a different type of fuel. And when all of that fuel comes together, there's this massive, massive, massive energy explosion that happens. And then people escape their own worldview. A key moment is being very aware of the different types of people that visit the college and the different types of post experiences that they have. And being very much aware that the college is a gathering of energies that for some, it might trigger them very much outside of the worldview and they need to reconstruct and build new gravity. And for others, it's just equipping them with better spaceships.
One word to describe the college is the coolest school I've ever gone to.
Joyful and challenging.
Overwhelmed, but in a positive way.
Cool. Before we get into some of the lighter stuff, right? All the things you've seen in the world, all the stuff you've done, Is there one experience that has been truly memorable and transformational that you can say, cool, this is done right? This transformed me as Paul.
Yeah, I think that was my first LARP. That was College of Wizardry. It is taking place at the same castle. It's just Harry Potter inspired.
Imagine that when you were really, 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 really little, you had amazing dreams, because we all had those dreams. They were fantastic. And then someone said, I can make them real. And you know, kind of, that they're, maybe it's not real real, but it's as close as you're possibly going to get. That's what this is.
And it is 4-day immersive experience where you're role-playing someone else. And in this case, I was role-playing a first-year student at the magical school. First thing, you're being equipped with the wand, and a wand means infinite possibility, because all of a sudden you can cast spells. And then other people have wands, and it's up to them whether they are throwing a counter spell or they're just accepting your spell and then doing their own interpretation of it. And I have this memorable moment. You have all of these professors that look scary and so on. And they're saying, at 10 o'clock, it's curfew, no students are allowed to go out anymore. Everyone has to go to their rooms. So I was really scared to go out, because you have a house like in Harry Potter. And then if you're being caught out by professors or monitors, you're getting minus points for your house. And of course, you want to win the house cup and bring your own individual contribution to it. And then we were like, I'm afraid of going out of my room, so I'm just going to sleep in. And that was the first night. And to me, looking back at that was, oh my God, I was like so afraid of the social norms, even though this was pretend play. And then the designers were actually putting this curfew so that I actually sneak out and feel like I'm sneaking out and have that experience.
It was actually a call to adventure, right?
Yeah, but I didn't get it. And then I also realized that as a player, I was really afraid of the professors and challenging them, because the suspension of disbelief was very high, and the professor's authority seemed real. It was actually real, right? Because it was a whole world built for them to have that authority feel real. And I was really afraid of challenging it. And then at one point, we ended up, someone ended up starting a revolution against the professors, where we had 100 students revolting against a body of 10 professors. And being part of that movement made me realize, I had like a eureka moment, saying, okay, I'm just in this pocket of designed world reality, where I'm just playing around with power dynamics, I'm playing around with storytelling, I'm playing around with rhetorics, I'm playing around with ethics, I'm playing around with so many things, especially imagination first and foremost. And ever since that moment, I'm traveling warp speed ahead.
Gather around, kids. It's story time.
But there's a little challenge here for you. And you need to tell a story that incorporates this quote. It'll be underwater and upside down.
Did you get this from Klaus?
Yes.
All of this, I'm not allowed to give names, so I'm going to use lots of, because it's under NDA, but I'm going to use my storytelling tricks.
Yeah.
So here I was on this very, very high level stage where world top creators had to present ideas of the future, right? In a pitch where we said, imagination, go beyond imagination, go as bold as you can, infinite budget, whatever. Yeah. So we could do anything. So we had this person present an idea to all of these business stakeholders, like, we're going to build this surf park. And it's not just any ordinary surf park. It's this artificial surf park. And we're going to make it underwater. And not only we're going to make it underwater, but we're also going to turn it upside down. I was just laughing so hard in my mind. And I was just looking at the public, at the business people nodding, slowly nodding their head. And I was like, this is crazy. So this is what happened when you go beyond imagination, right? Yeah. It's like, this is a trap of once you are being asked to come up with bold ideas, you just go on crazy bold ideas.
And maybe also when you get to a point where your idea consists of being underwater and upside down, it's time to kill the darling.
Yeah. Or just add a higher level of confusion where you, It's underwater, it's upside down, and it's full of clowns.
That's why I love working with you, mate. You also have a podcast, and it involves monkeys.
Yes. So we have an experience design podcast. I think, Werner, we show them the link in notes.
I will do exactly that.
And the way we're doing this is, I think it's very much Klaus and I style, which is no planning involved. We're just very spontaneous. It's you will not find it on a regular basis. It will just pop up here and there at different times. And we just do random discussions with people that don't know they're on a podcast. And we do all sorts of crazy things, live rapid prototyping.
And there's animals.
And every episode has a different animal sound. And
can you do the monkeys?
Only if you do them with me.
How does the monkeys go again?
At three, you just go full crazy monkey.
Okay, I'm doing it.
One, two, three.
Okay, that's a maximum. I was not going to mention at the beginning of the show because then we have to do it all throughout with your kind of format. I can't believe I did
that. Yeah, but actually, this is really good for mental reframing.
It's
actually,
it's kind of releases energy. Yeah, it's like it releases energy. It's a good thing to do. Moving from monkeys to mentors, do you have any?
Yes, I do have. Recently started a mentorship with Burnett Bain, who is a beautiful human being, a film producer, and also is very much into meditation and spirituality, wrote some books and is a practitioner. This is one, and the other one is Alexa. She is the founder of Atlas Unbound, which is an experience about connecting people with nature. So these are my two mentors, and of course Klaus. But we're doing reverse mentorship on each other, and I think the special relations that Klaus and I have is that we're completely honest to each other, and we don't take bullshit from each other.
Yeah, I've seen that in action, and that is something to behold.
Yes, that is really valuable, but it's also very energy draining type of mentorship.
Is there a book that you can recommend that someone should grab after listening to this that is inspirational?
Something that I'm reading at the moment that is inspirational is called Wonder Book. It's called The Illustrated Guide to Creating Imaginative Fiction by Jeff Vandermeer. And this goes back to my quote that the universe is made of stories, not of atoms that I mentioned. It's a quote by a poet. I think the more and more you go into the experience design, the more and more you start understanding that what you're creating is fiction. So I think learning more about how to create fiction will make you into a better experience designer. And this book is one of the best that I found so far on teaching you how to do that. It is an experience in itself. So definitely recommend this one.
There's a rumor that there's another book on the way, sir.
Yes, there is another book on the way. I'm writing this together with two other co-authors, Barbara Neuhofer from Salzburg University, who's a PhD in experience design and heads the experience design department, and with Klaus
Rauschstedt,
about how to design transformational experiences. I mean, this is what we're thinking of now, whether that's going to tweak or iterate or change into something else. We're going to find out during the process. As everyone knows, writing a book is always a voyage.
And then, Paul, something I wanted to ask you earlier, but I forgot because I'm a bad host, is that you know that Olga asked you a question. So for my next mystery guest on Block Thinking, is there a Paul question that I could ask them?
Let me think about it. How do you define success in experience design?
Excellent. I'll do that. And Paul, as I wrap up with this, if people want to follow you, get hold of you, see what you're up to, maybe learn a little bit about the book, Gamification and Tourism, where should they find this and find you?
I think I'm most, in terms of social media, I'm most active on Instagram. So that's my first name dot my last name. So paul.bulencia. I think you have to write that down.
Yeah, I'll pop that in the show notes.
People can reach me out at my email, which will also be in the show notes. And then they can find information about the book and a blog that is quite outdated, but has lots of great examples on the book website. And I definitely recommend people to check the joebach.studio page, where they will find lots of information about LARPs that we're up to.
Paul, I just want to say thank you to you for spending this time. I mean, it went all over the place. And yeah, good luck with the future endeavors. I'm really looking forward to observe and see what is going to come out of that crazy money next.
Thank you, Werner, for the beautiful time and the questions. And I have a question for you, actually, for your next show.
Oh, yeah?
So I'm going to spin this a little bit. Is like, what sound does a giraffe make?
What sound does a giraffe make? I should know this. I'm from Africa, damn it.
Yeah, you have more than enough time to think about that or research it.
Dude, thank you very much, man.
Thanks, Werner.
Thanks for listening to Block Thinking. You can find more information and the show notes for this episode at www.blockthinking.com. That is blockthinking without the K. com. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or any of your favorite podcast platforms. We thrive on critique, so feel free to leave comments on iTunes or get hold of us directly. Thanks for listening.